Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Good to have your company. Today, a great program about the Forgotten Force. They're the thousands of Australian men and women who volunteered to join the Allied occupation of Japan at the end of World War II. Less than 6 months after the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan was in ruins and its people were starving. The Allies set up an occupation force there. From the end of the war until 1952, more than 16,000 Australians spent time there as part of the British Commonwealth Occupation Force, or BCOF. As you're about to hear, the experience of those Australians involved prejudice and power, but also love and friendship. In this program, you'll hear from historian Robin Gerster, whose book about this era is called Travels in Atomic Sunshine. And you'll hear the stories of some of the people who went to rebuild the country they saw as a recent bitter enemy. Occupational Hazards, the Australian Story of BCOF, was produced by Michelle Rayner.
What else is there in Japan? Old men making pots, moulded out of the ash of the bomb, bearing MacArthur's thumbprint.
Japan has been disarmed. Emperor Hirohito's Imperial Army is home in defeat. Japan's war leaders are on trial. They were the masters of treachery. But these men are no longer the rulers of Japan. Men who fought to overthrow their reign of terror now direct the lives and destinies of Japan's 73 million.
Sometimes I wondered what I, the occupation soldier, was doing to Japan. Very soon I was to wonder what Japan was doing to me.
I can say a kaga deska or a kura deska, you know,
deska.
The
how do you feel? Yoroshi desu. That means I am well.
Domo arigato. That's who you are. Yeah, my Japanese isn't very good, you know.
I'd say the konnichiwa and the takashiwa gosho no runjun ni Japan. I was a Japanese soldier in Japan and that sort of stuff.
I used to, every now and then, go and see the mayor, Shinso Hamai. I'd have an interpreter. After about my third trip, my interpreter said, you know, his English is better than yours.
I noticed in the war memorial recently, I went to have a look at the occupation display there, which is very small. A suitcase, a leave pass, I think a booklet called Japanese in 3 weeks, and a box brownie camera, which kind of encapsulates a view of the occupation as a travel experience, pure and simple.
Hiroshima, Japan. The atom bomb has left a scarred earth. The survivors, a scarred people. Allied policy is laid down in Washington by the Far Eastern Commission and carried out by the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers. The function of the Allied Council is to advise the Supreme Commander on the execution of occupation policy.
Australia, as has become practice, very eagerly put up its hand to enter this US-led occupation, but with good reason. They were a major belligerent in the war, had fought the Japanese, and felt some right to partake in not so much the fruits of victory, but to have a say in running Japan, neutering it and making sure that it didn't become a security threat down the line. But also, to its credit, the Australian government had a benign project in mind for Japan and constructive ideas for democratising the place, for opening up the labour market, for giving women the vote. Chifley's Light on the Hill speech, you know, working for the betterment of mankind, even applied to the benighted Japanese. So the government, at least, theoretically, wanted to play a constructive part in the remaking of Japan and to flex its muscle in the Asia Pacific. I mean, this was a real watershed in Australian international relations. For the first time, really, Australia asserting its right to influence the affairs of the Asia Pacific, and in a constructive way, by and large, it would have to be said.
At the order of the Allies, a line of Jap buses waits to transport American troops into Yokohama. On the back of the buses are contraptions that look strange to the Americans who have not had to use them. But Australians know a gas producer when they see it. We've talked about being on the road to Tokyo. Well, there's no doubt about it now.
Most of those volunteers who put their hand up wanted to go to Japan for various reasons, but one of which was that they didn't want to go home. Some of them had only got into the war rather late in proceedings and feel that they'd missed out, and Japan represented an opportunity just to extend their military service abroad. Some saw occupying Japan as the sort of logical end of a long and bitter and vicious war, and some felt that putting a boot on the prostrate neck of Japanese was an appealing prospect, as the novelist Hungerford mentions. Others, really, because they were young and didn't really know what they wanted to do with their lives.
Watashi no tomodachi wa shijo inoue-san. Tomodachi means friend.
Arigato.
Do itashimashita. Don't mention it. I was with the Air Force, camped in three different places as a medical orderly, Bofu, Iwakuni and Hiroshima. I arrived there in February 1947 and was posted home in October 1950.
When the atom bomb dropped and the war was over and we were told that medical personnel couldn't get out under 12 months because of all the POWs coming back, just after that, they called for volunteers for Japan. And nearly all the hospital volunteered, and I was about the only one, I was the only one that was accepted. And the government at the time wouldn't let Australian females go overseas unless they were medical. So we were selected. Needless to say, the trip to Japan took 14 days on the hospital ship Manunda. We had Japanese lessons on the way every day. And they'd had the last snowfall on the 20th of March, and we arrived there on the 23rd of March.
What year was that?
1946. Yeah, 6 months after the atom bomb had been dropped.
Life is creeping back over Earth seared by the atom bomb. For out of the soil of Hiroshima, crops are growing as they've never grown before. The Allied powers have stripped the landowners and given the earth back to the peasants. Now the women work with a new heart, believing that the roots of democracy have been sown in Japanese soil. Women who helped to carry the burden of war now bend their backs to the work of reconstruction.
I was actually in India when they wanted volunteers to go to Japan. And when I went to Japan, I was with a movement control unit, and they're the people that look after the railways and so on. And I'd never done that sort of thing before. So I was put on the team at Kurei Railway Station. This meant that I had to put on ordinary Japanese freight trains, boxcars or gondolas, which were carrying army supplies. And to do this, I had an interpreter, Joe, who was a Nisei Japanese. And he had been deported to Japan. He'd been returned to Japan. He'd never been in Japan. In fact, I'd been in Japan longer than he had.
This is Radio Australia calling. Here is the news read by John Winston.
Today, Japanese radio and press are bringing news of a free world to the news-hungry people of Japan.
I enlisted in the army in 1946, following that advertising campaign by the government seeking volunteers. So I was prompted to join up as an 18-year-old, and after that I was posted to signals training, linesmen, radio operators, mechanics, all sorts of skill training. Somehow I was selected amongst others to undergo cipher training. A number of us, of course, went to Japan.
The army got in touch with me because they knew that I was a journalist, because I'd said so when I, of course, enlisted. I was a cadet journalist at the Sydney Sun, and they said, we're forming a newspaper in Japan, which is called Beacon, which is British Commonwealth Occupation News, and we could use you if you'd like to go, but you have to sign on for 2 years.
Our
Our landfall in Japan was at Kure, on the island of Honshu, alongside a dirty wharf and its sheds of battered galvanized iron. I'd expected something a bit more exotic, perhaps bamboo and rice paper ornamented with storks and irises, as on the Japanese tin tea caddy I'd stared at on the kitchen mantel shelf. There was nothing at all storybook about the Kure wharves. We landed in the eerie shadow of the rust-red forest of ruined cranes we'd been able to see from afar off all day. The building outside which we halted, eventually, was not one to raise expectations of any armchair ride through the occupation. Grey, desolate, repellently unwelcoming in the early freezing dusk which had overtaken us by the time we hove to on the roadway in front of it. I said to the lieutenant, who democratically had sloshed hither with us, "Looks as if we weren't expected." We could not have been more contemptuously given the back of the American hand.
Australia was, or BCOF, a British Commonwealth Occupation Force, ultimately led by Australian generals, was given the Booby Prize, which was Hiroshima Prefecture, some 900 k's from Tokyo, in the centre of the action, where MacArthur was ensconced in his royal court with his faithful retainers. So Hiroshima, of course, had been atom-bombed, and it was a kind of a backwater anyway, a long way from the action. It was sort of distance between Melbourne and Sydney, 900 kilometres. Historically very poor, and after August 1945, atom-bombed as well. The cynic might say that the Americans gave us that part of Japan because it had been irradiated, but and there will be some Australians who will tell you that, but in fact, of course, the Americans were there from September 45. There was a substantial American force in that area before the Australians went in, so I think we can dispose of that. Mm. But yes, it was, to use the unkind expression, the arse end of Japan, and I think there is, in fact, a Japanese expression along those lines describing that general region of Western Honshu as a provincial backwater.
And it wasn't until we got into Kure Harbour that the realism occurred that, you know, all this beauty which we'd seen for several hours prior to coming up, and here we were in a place which was still largely in ruins.
We arrived at Iwakuni, which was the Air Force base up there, and we all sort of taken aboard and sort of fed, and we were fed in the usual sort of hut where you had your Dixie and you walked around and got your food and all the rest of it, and they had the usual bins where you put your slops in. And when I came out, we all were virtually attacked by Japanese kids, absolutely starving, and you couldn't get anywhere near the bins because they virtually were on top of you. And I hated the Japs because I was trained to hate the Japs. I'd been in their damn country for a week or less than a week. And I screamed at them and shouted at them with all the rest of them and pushed them out of the way. And wasn't very long, only a month or two before I realised what I'd done and how horrible it was. Those kids were starving.
In Kure, we were in this deserted building. We're on the first floor of it, and we had below us a whole lot of elderly Japanese ladies smoking their little cheroots or whatever they call them, and they were stuffing mattresses.
So I finished up in Etajima, which was quite a pleasant little island, accessible only by boat. Pretty Spartan sort of a place. It was the headquarters then of BCOF on Etajima.
Got off the ship in Kure. We were shunted out to Yoshura, which is about 10 k's out of Kure, and we were put in an old naval barracks. And it was quite good because I had a nice room to myself, except all of us there for the first few weeks, we got bruises across here because we would walk out of the doors forgetting, you know.
How much shorter the Japanese people were.
Under Allied guidance, the gradual rebirth of Japan is taking place. On the earth of Hiroshima, buildings are going up.
What did the Australian forces do there initially?
Well, in the first 1 to 2 years, they did quite a lot. I mean, Japan was one big ammunition dump at the end of the war, particularly in Western Japan, and the Australians performed a very serious role in disarming the place, a dangerous role, bomb disposal, getting rid of chemical weapons and so on. So there's that role. There was the role of reconnaissance and watching the waterways for contraband and so on, although that could prove quite a handy role for some people. They played a role in the overseeing of the first Japanese elections, and which gave the vote to women for the first time. A general role in reconstruction, including Hiroshima, lending expertise to the rebuilding of that city and cleaning up and so on. I mean, these aren't glamorous roles. It was work. It wasn't sort of daring do. It was constructive work, but it was work. Now, after those roles were more or less completed, the force lapsed into a kind of parody, really, of an occupying force. And a lot of emphasis on parades, spit and polish, especially outside the palace in Tokyo, because that looked good, and just a general air of sort of fatuous military fastidiousness, putting on a show. For no real point, it would have to be said. I guess it became more and more like a working holiday, yes, as the occupation progressed.
I had never thought about Japan. I imagined that Japan was a sort of a flat place with these little houses on. My first impression was, when we went into the inland sea, that it was mountainous. And I was really surprised. It's a mountainous place, you know. And the roads were right down on the water side.
Well, what did you know about Japanese people?
Nothing. I thought that they were short.
And, of course, the thing is, you don't see yourself as being different and moving among people of a different race. And on Sundays, I used to just get onto a train and go somewhere from Osaka just for a change. I'd get up. I think, oh, this place looks good. I'd get up. And I got off the train and walked down from the station. And just as I was walking down the main street, and it was a Sunday, so it was fairly quiet, a woman and a little girl came around the corner. And they stopped in horror and looked at me. I thought, what have I done? And they ran. And, of course, I realised that I was probably the first non-Japanese that I had ever seen.
No, there was no real preparation at all. So it was, in a sense, a great shock, because we really didn't know what was going to happen.
What did you know of Japan before?
Nothing, except that they were a country that, you know, with killers, and we had to do something about them. I was well-trained, I can tell you, to hate them, and I, of course, found out that I was wrong.
One Sunday afternoon, a few of us borrowed a jeep and drove into the farmland above Kurei. We entered into a copybook Japanese landscape, a long rising valley terraced with stone into small plots. I don't know whether we were overcome with the beauty of the surroundings or the miasma of the fields, but we realised we'd lost our way. At this point, a lone Japanese walked around the bend in the road, a local farmer, we decided. We had a few words of Japanese, and it was just possible that we'd be able to get some directions from him. Anone, kure e doko de ka kudasai? I was hoping that I'd said more or less politely, Kure, where is it, please? To our utter amazement, that dusty farmer said to me in perfect English, Good afternoon, sir. Have you lost your way? It turned out that for most of his life he'd been an English teacher in a high school in Kure. He invited us back to his home, which he told us was quite close. It was still early days in the occupation and we'd not had any chances to mix with ordinary Japanese families. In fact, we'd been expressly forbidden to fraternise with the locals. We crammed the teacher into the jeep and in a few minutes had pulled up in front of his house. It was tourist pretty, with white plaster and dark wood. It had the traditional plaited straw charm above the door and paper strips of crimson characters pasted onto the door itself. I remarked on these characters to one of the blokes in the Jeep, who replied, "How do you know it doesn't mean fuck the Aussies?" T. Hungerford.
Going up on the ship there, they were saying, "Oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, and don't eat this, and don't eat that." And one bloke put his hand up, "Sir, is there anything we can do up there?" Because we didn't take any notice of that.
Know Japan, an essential background to the understanding of Japan and its people, February 1946. Relations with the conquered enemy should be formal and correct at all times. Japanese homes are not to be entered into, nor a serviceman to participate in any manner in the lives of the local population.
Guidebooks were issued to the soldiers to prepare them for the encounter. One called Know Japan, which was prefaced by this non-fraternisation edict, so which was an unusual way to begin a guidebook. In other words, you were to know Japan by having nothing whatsoever to do with the people.
Any unofficial dealings with the Japanese are to be kept to a minimum.
So there's a lot of sort of ethnographic and geographical information in the guidebook, a lot of it sort of culturally driven. There's a portrayal of the average Japanese male who is dubbed Suzuki-san, who was a sort of walking volcano of repressed passion and anger, and warnings about the numbers of diseases you would be likely to pick up, including VD, because all those Japanese women were diseased and they're out to get you, of course. So there was that rather unhelpful text. All interactions between the Australians and the Japanese were to be kept at a formal level, and you were forbidden to enter Japanese homes. Of course, this was disregarded by the troops.
Servicemen are in Japan as representatives of the British Commonwealth and all that it stands for in the world.
One of the rules, which was wrong, we all thought so at the time, and so did the Americans, was non-fraternisation. That was in the Beecroft area. And, you know, you couldn't fraternise with them. Well, how the hell, you know, you're going to get to know them if you couldn't fraternise with them?
Stupid thing to bring out on blokes who are bloody 21, 22 and sort of thing, and full of bloody hops.
It would be a military offence if you were caught fraternising with the Japanese, and I think that was unrealistic to try and do this, because there were so many Japanese and so few of us that it was inevitable that people were going to form some sort of relationships, and it didn't have to be men with women, but certainly in day-to-day affairs. Most Japanese were probably decent sort of people, yeah, most.
At the RAAF Linguist School in Melbourne, Army and Air Force personnel learn to read and speak Japanese. Students have to memorize between 2,000 and 3,000 Japanese characters, each of which can be written in 6 different ways. No wonder 50% can't take it and drop out, yet 8 WAFs have completed the course. The school is under the direction of Squadron Leader Vidrovsky, RAAF.
By and large, the troops were left to their own devices, and to their credit, many of them made a concerted attempt to go beyond the stereotypes. Many of them actually learning Japanese even, which is a noble effort. Learning about the culture, travelling around, even learning Ikebana. Big Australian beefy guys learning flower arranging. Can you imagine it? So some soldiers made the effort to throw away their guidebooks and did it for themselves. In other words, the guidebooks were useless.
Hot ginger and dynamite. We drink nothing but that and wow, boy. Back neck, shake a better fella. Chew the back around the wind, wiggy wacky.
I remember one of the nurses was talking to me, and she said, "I can't understand why the men go out with these Japanese girls when we've got our own girls there. Well, there's only about 5 girls on the camp, but how many men?"
How heavily then did the Australian commanders try and enforce the non-fraternisation rule?
It was enforced and it wasn't. I mean, it was an absurd rule when you're trying to reconstruct a country, and a lot of Japanese were employed by the occupation to rebuild and so on. You are naturally fraternising. The black market, indeed, was a form of, which was rampant, was a form of fraternisation, let alone the sexual exchange between soldiers and women. They attempted, alarmed by the vaulting venereal disease rates, especially among the Australian forces, which were about double what they should have been, although it might be argued that the Australian medical services were a bit more rigorous than some of the others, but alarmed by those rates, an official system of brothels was contemplated, but very quickly stymied, particularly by the chaplains. There's a famous case of the chaplains ordering the burning down of one brothel on Christmas Eve, which really was rather churlish, actually.
I met a couple of American nurses. The first thing they said is, what the VD like amongst you?
I was part of a production team that did a film on VD, and what we had is a couple of doctors who had some of these girls who were, you know, prostitutes. A lot of girls who would never have prostituted themselves were prostitutes because they got money from the troops, and the rest of it was all done underhand. Anyway, I remember on this particular occasion they had the doctors there, and they had one or two of these poor girls, and they had them on a bunk, and then they showed you what they had. They actually, in front of the camera, delicately, if you like, opened the vaginas while the girl was there and showed the camera in there just how red and raw, oh, how awful it was. Anyway, then they produced the film, and I was there the first night it was shown at one of the army. They had a couple of thousand troops there. You should have heard it. Oh, no! Oh, Christ! Gee, give it away! I think it put some of them off for life.
Yeah, I think we all had to go and see the film about VD. It was intended to frighten you. It had all these pictures of things you don't want to talk about. But yeah, there were certainly soldiers who formed more stable relationships with Japanese women. And of course, there were others who went to women who worked in brothels and those sort of things. And, or women who took them down to the tunnels and all these sort of places. Mates who were provos, of course, you'd pick up these women and you'd have them take them home, checked up by the doctors that said they didn't have it, and then you could... And I think, unfortunately for Japanese women, a lot of the blokes did that sort of thing and then came home and just left them, and I think that was probably unethical sort of behaviour.
Actually, I'm almost certain of the last 12 months I was there, we only had one case, which is pretty good, because nearly everyone had girlfriends.
But it's interesting that it was necessary for them to make that film, because that's the way it was going, the black market and, of course, all this sex and one thing and another.
There was this sort of running argument amongst the Japanese also, the Americans and... renegade Australian commentators that the Australian force was out of control and, in fact, should be sent home.
I suppose I wasn't in that sort of circle, you know. When you're sort of mainly with headquarters people, the hospital people and so forth. No, I know there was VD and so on. I'm not aware of, you know, obvious drunkenness and so forth, but then I probably wasn't moving in the same circle.
On one occasion, there was a girl was murdered quite close to our camp, about a kilometre away, on a bomb site. And her head had been smashed in with a rock. And I remember, you know, I used to take pictures, whatever pictures came my way. So I would probably hesitate very much even to go near. In any event, somebody had said that they thought they saw an Australian soldier near.
Okay.
And so we had an identification parade, and we lined up in the corridor in our very nice barracks, and we ranged from about 3 metres tall to about 2 metres tall, and the little man who had made the claim that he had been an Australian somewhere near, he was brought in by the American military police. The major with his club was there, and the little man walked up and down, looking at our faces. The American military police major very soon became irritated by the fact that he wasn't saying, well, that was the guy, you know. and he was thumping his white truncheon in his hand. And finally he said to our interpreter, who was a Korean, who actually worked with us in the newsroom, but he was a Korean, "Well, what does he say?" He said, "Sir, all Australians have the same face."
In some ways, the Australians were a sort of easy target, an scapegoat. There was still the view abroad, probably spread by the British, that the Australians were the progeny of convicts and they were just performing to type. And I mean, the American behaviour on arrival in Japan in September of 45 was not exactly spotless. However, there's enough hard and anecdotal evidence to suggest that there was an element in the Australian forces, possibly quite a large element, that engaged in casual violence of one form or other against the Japanese.
I stood beside a bed in the hospital. On it lay a girl, unconscious, her long black hair in a wild tumult on the pillow. A doctor and two nurses were working to revive her. The eyes of the doctor and nurses turned questioningly, unemotionally towards me. I'd seen that look many times before, in this same hospital. Always it said this: "So, we are barbarians and you are civilized. And this is your way of life that you fought against us to preserve. And you now command us to accept."
It was Time of Fallen Blossoms.
Alan S. Clifton.
Came out in 1950. Clifton was a Japanese speaker. Went to Japan as an interpreter and engaged in intelligence, largely based in Hiroshima. And his book was a very frank, shocking account of Australian malfeasance, and one particularly confronting scene involving a pack rape of a Japanese woman in Hiroshima, and other pictures of Australian brutality and vandalism caused a stink in Australia. Clifton was discreetly discredited by the army.
I knew Alan Clifton, of course. He was slammed at the time when the book was produced. He was slammed. And very, very highly criticised about his book, because the notion was, well, Australians wouldn't do that.
So a test case of a certain kind of intolerance in Australia to a picture of the war which was confronting and controversial. It wasn't something that they wanted to hear. On the other hand, I mean, you looked at it another way, Clifton's book is a kind of inspiring story, because it's one which is suffused with a really educated affinity and knowledge of Japanese culture, and the argument, a humanistic argument about Japanese culture as not being all about shouting soldiers, and the idea of, for the Japanese as well as Australians, that you've just got to move on, otherwise you're going to be stuck in the mire of wartime hatred.
My name, Mari. Family name is Mari, M-U-R-R-I-A-Y.
Where did you meet Keith?
I met him at Iwakuni.
Well, you're working for the Australian Air Force. Iwakuni is an interpreter.
Secretary interpreter.
So you were part of the occupation forces?
Yeah,
and you were,
yeah.
I met him about 47 or 8.
48.
And then under the those days situation, woman has not much work to do. So-called street girl or waitress, cleaner, but I don't like that. And then I have had a little bit English, so I came to work at Iwakuni Air Base, where he was an engineering officer.
I used to take a Japanese girl to
little functions that the Americans put on. You could take them along on one night to do roller skating, you could take them along to the dance on Saturday night and so on. And she actually worked for the Americans. And she couldn't speak very much English, and I could speak less Japanese than she could speak English. But somehow we managed to go, and we'd have little walks and things like that, and it was quite a pleasant sort of arrangement. But some had, you know, much more definitive relationships with Japanese girls. They knew, you know. Of course, after you'd been there for a while, the Japanese began to look much less Japanese than when you first got there.
I remember one day one of the sisters was carrying on about something, and I said in Japanese, don't get excited, because the girls started laughing. And
so you were lucky that you had such a good grasp of Japanese.
Yeah, yeah.
And was it just through knowing Sam, or Shin, how do you say his name?
Shizuo Inoue.
So when you met, how old was Sam, Shin?
I was 22, I think he was 17. And when I was posted to Hiroshima, it's a radar unit, so it's only a small unit. And I had him, and I was the only medical staff there. And that's how we became friends. I used to go around to his place. You know, I was number one son. Yeah, and he said to me, he said, you bought some potatoes and that around there and showed us how to make chips. I don't remember that. When I returned from Japan, I had a lot of Japanese money in my kit bag. I don't know why. And when the other brother was going up there, I said, well, give this to Sam. So he gave it to him, and Sam said, I bought what I always wanted was a push bike. He said, and that probably helped me to get the job that he got, which he stayed there for, I think, 42 years.
You know, you were able to live in Japan for 6 years. Did you ever become close, friends with...
With any Japanese? No, not really, no. No, I've been in the army for over 10 years, you know, eventually. And you have army friends.
But you did learn some of the language.
Oh, yes. Mushi mushi nanane or something, or chotomari kudasai or something. But what's the matter? That's
what does
about
that mean?
All. Well, just a minute, please. It's chotomari kudasai. We had house girls, and between us we'd have pidgin English. The house girls were, you couldn't fault them really. But the males, I don't know, I wouldn't trust one.
And I befriended in a way a Japanese that I'd known who was a Christian who was in Hiroshima. And he'd suffered burns down the side of his face. He had a sort of a nut brown side of one of his face. He worked for the Australians as a clerk. He spoke pretty good English. Mm-hmm. And his name was Frank. He had a Christian sort of a name. And I'd probably give him chocolate or something like that. I used to look after a young kid too. He had all his hair shaved off. I think what that skin complaint. The Australians used to call him Spike because that's what his hair looked like. This kid called Spike. And Spike was learning English. And the Australian soldiers teach them all the bad things, of course.
What, swear words
and
stuff?
Yeah, all swear words and, yeah. But that is night. Back in Akazaka,
then eventually, of course, the wives came up, and that sort of made them socialise them a bit better, I suppose, as far as some of the fellows were concerned.
The families of the Beekhoff men who joined the force from the middle of 1947 were provided with another guidebook called Beekhoff Bound, which I think the non-fraternisation edict appeared at the end of that book. And there's a lot of information there about how one dealt with one's Japanese servants and, for example, the stipulation that you shouldn't have much to do with them and that shouldn't be too hard.
BCOF Bound, a guidebook for service families and dependents. 1. It is recommended that close contact with the Japanese be limited to those employed in domestic or other service. 2. The provision of unconsumed food to your Japanese domestic staff is permissible. 3. You will find that if you treat your servants well, they will become devoted to you.
Hope you lived with us.
All right. Mm. And some of your house staff spoke English?
Well, she learnt English and very well too.
And it sounds like you had a very, you know, warm relationship, friendship with your, with Sissy.
Oh, yes, Sissy Coke, the bad son. Yes, yes. Oh, she was fantastic. Mm-hmm. She was terrified when she came to the house and Mother interviewed her, because she was under the impression she'd be beaten and, you know, treated badly.
Infidels.
Yes.
But there were rules for them too. They yes. had to go through the guard and were checked. Their bags checked. Were checked.
Everything was
that
checked.
They didn't pinch anything. Mm. A lot of them got, the mothers in the household giving them a bit of soap or something like that or food, they weren't allowed to, were they? No.
What do you remember of the occupation forces when you were in Japan?
A secretary's interpreter.
Yeah. Mm. You were in charge of the girls' dormitory as well. On the base, they had a big dormitory for all the girls who worked on the base.
There
were some nasty people. There were some families of the occupation forces who used to make some of the housemaids and cleaners upset. Like, for example, when a cook was trying to make something like the meat croquet, the Australian wives would say to the cook, "Don't use your hands, because Japanese hands are dirty." But it's pretty hard to make a meatball shape using a fork. I think some of the Australians were just unsophisticated country folk. One of the housemaids who lived in my dormitory would always come back crying. I couldn't believe some of the awful behaviour. I saw one Australian couple fighting one time, and the wife was chasing the husband with a rifle.
No. See? Wife is carrying a rifle. To fight.
Oh, yeah, to be expected, yes.
Oh. Expected, really?
Well, it was just another Australian town. That's what it amounted to. The problem there was, and this applied to many of the Australians, both male and female, they had no idea how to handle servants or employees quite often. Mm. No experience.
The Japanese child accepts the sudden invasion of his life by numbers of alien children with white skins, the sons and daughters of Allied servicemen. But he accepts it with caution. East meets west, and east goes south in a hurry.
Being with my parents, of course, we lived in Kure at first for a short while, and we had servants, of course, and the cook we called Errol Flynn because he was tall, dark and handsome.
Was he Japanese?
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, the poor man got TB and had to leave at some stage, but he would arrive on the doorstep with a huge fish for us or something.
And how old were you when you arrived?
14. But it was absolutely beautiful. We weren't allowed to fraternise, of course, at that time.
How was that manageable? Did you sort of keep a distance?
No, we did fraternise. Well, I did. I used to have a bicycle. And
so did you meet other Japanese children of your own?
No, very seldom, very seldom. My mother, you probably read in the book, I've got the photographs of her orphanage there. And she started that because one of the soldiers discovered these children living virtually under a house, which was bombed. About 23 of them, ranging in size from tiny to 3 or 4. So he and mother got together and started this orphanage, had everybody organised to make them clothes and feed them. And
there was a building made available?
Yes. So that was marvellous. Then we had, do you remember Staff Sergeant Clayton?
Yeah.
We had a wonderful time. Staff Sergeant Clayton taught us all to type and shorthand, and he was marvellous to us children. Climbed Mount Fujiyama, which was the most incredible thing. Okay. I've still got my stick. You still got your stick?
Mary has.
The ruins of post-war Japan were one huge playground where everything forbidden was now allowed, and clandestine meetings were held under the noonday sun.
Heavily guarded is the Grand Hotel Yokohama, which became the first headquarters of General MacArthur. no longer just the Allied commander, but the new commander of Japan.
And there's a very famous photograph, of course, of the very tall, handsome, casually dressed MacArthur looking confidently at the camera while this very stiff, formal, absurdly dressed in top hat and tails, Hirohito standing very stiffly behind him, overshadowed. The Japanese police censors wanted the photograph banned because it was demeaning, and that order was very quickly rescinded by the US authorities, who, although they were there to instill democracy into the Japanese, didn't really believe in free speech.
Tell me a little bit about the Australian military command, because in a sense, you know, they're also larger-than-life characters, particularly Robbie Robertson.
Yes, very sort of charismatic soldier, known as Red Robbie, not for his politics, which were of the deeply conservative kind, but for his shock of red hair. He was a war hero, a great advocate for his men, an assertive character, and stood up to MacArthur. So in that sense, he was very good for the occupation. Not so fond of the Japanese. He's kind of infamous for a famous speech that he gave at the Peace Festival on the occasion, I think, of the third anniversary of the dropping of the bomb, where he got up on a podium with a lot of dignitaries assembled there in a waiting audience, mostly of women and children. Hiroshima was still a wreck in 1948, and proceeded to tell them that it was all their fault, and that they needed to learn the lesson of the bomb, and it was retribution. He was a charismatic type, but rather limited in terms of his ability to see the Japanese as anything other than the enemy, which was sort of characteristic of a lot of the leadership of the occupation. They saw the occupation as an extension of the war.
It isn't easy to change the way of life, the mode of thinking of 80 million people. But Matsuno-san will be pleased and a little amazed to know that a section of opinion among his conquerors, and a powerful section, believe that one day, and in some future war, he and his people may be allies of the Western democracies. The conflict of interests between Russia and America sets the tone of events in Japan today. If there is a Third World War, Matsuno-san and every other Japanese is probably wondering who will offer him the better terms, Washington or Moscow?
It was an occupation whose initial object was to democratize Japan and demilitarize Japan. But it was a benevolent dictatorship with an autocratic insistence on democracy with a capital D. Democratize or else. This was initially. Later on, towards the end of the occupation, there was this so-called reverse course, where suddenly making Japan a good conservative client in the global struggle against communism, read China and Russia, that became more important, and indeed the Japanese were basically rearmed, and a lot of the war criminals rehabilitated, and so on. So the Australians tended to stick more insistently, the Australian government at least, to the initial ideals of remaking the country. But
so Menzies adopted that kind of philosophy.
Menzies, when he came to power, readily acquiesced with the new policy, which was let's stabilise Japan as a good conservative client state, and let's not worry too much about democracy. And having let out a lot of the red raggers, communists who had been jailed by the Japanese regime, a lot of them were put back in, and there was always a totalitarian press code enforced by MacArthur. So criticism of the occupation was not contemplated on the basis that it would disturb public tranquility, which was the phrase used. So dissenting Japanese voices were stifled, and indeed the stories of the Japanese survivors of Hiroshima were completely snuffed out. It was only after the occupation left that these survivor stories were brought to light. Something that the Americans took a long time to come to terms with.
One of the things I remember that was most noticeable is that all the kids would wave at you and one thing another, and they're all shouting, goodbye. Not hello, goodbye. It was, in other words, to say, clear off. And a lot of people never woke up to that. They think, you know, well, they mean good, but they mean hello, but they meant goodbye. Go!
It's odd how, almost like Vietnam War, which they simply shut their minds to, and the occupation just ceased to exist when it ended.
Lucas, why do you think Beecoff, the Japan experience, is so little remembered in Australia?
I don't know. Now, you see, the Vietnam veterans, they made such a fuss when they came back, whereas the Beecoff people didn't, and they were really shunned.
The Beecoff.
Yeah. I think the people in Australia, they'd only heard bad things about them and so forth. A forgotten force. Even now, they don't recognise as service as being overseas service or anything.
I think that's right. I think there's very little known. I think a lot of the reporting which was done had tended to colour what the real role of the occupation was.
There was a lot of press reportage, particularly from the conservative press, remembering it was a Labor government at the time that had sent the Australians there, complaining about the conditions under which the Australians were serving. But after, I guess, a lot of the negative stuff started kicking in, reportage of venereal disease rates and VD patients were being sent home, repatriated, cases of neurosis and so on, a bleaker picture of the occupation started being circulated, and there were some sensational stories of moral corruption and the black market and the rest of them. So for the public at home, that seemed just about right. In other words, if you're going to touch pitch, then it leaves its mark. And there's always this element in Australia that we shouldn't be there, let the bastards stew, you know. So the negative reportage fed a kind of discourse of anti-Japanese-ness, and, you know, we shouldn't have anything to do with these people, and if you do, this is what happens.
There was a lot of defence of the occupation, there's no doubt about that. We were there for the right reasons, etc., etc., and we were probably there too long in the end, but I don't think we did a bad job.
You can, at least, see the occupation, or the men and women of the occupation, as kind of trailblazers in, of a new era in Australian engagement with the Japanese. And that put them at odds, actually, with the people at home, who very much hung on to tenacious anti-Japanese stereotypes, which were, of course, fed by Japanese barbarity during the war. That, to a degree, is understandable, of course. But the men and women returning from Japan, often with wives or fiancés, would you believe, but even with positive attitudes to the Japanese, were in many cases regarded with outright hostility and would sit on their experiences for fear of offending their fellows, or for fear of looking like they'd gone soft, you know. They were up against it from the beginning in terms of the Anzac tradition, the war tradition and so on, because they weren't fighting the enemy, they were occupying.
What else is there in Japan? Old men making pots, moulded out of the ash of the bomb, bearing MacArthur's thumbprint.
In Occupational Hazards, the Australian Story of Beecoff, you heard the historian Robin Gerster. His book, Travels in Atomic Sunshine, won the New South Wales Premier's History Prize in 2009. It's published by Scribe. You also heard from Gordon Edwards, Mary Murray, Mavis Lay, Jack Griffiths, James Holmes and Stuart Inder, as well as the Beecoff Kids Group members, Rosemary Carmen and Prue Keyes. T.E. Hungerford's memoir of his time in Japan was read by Neil Piggott, who also read extracts from Time of Fallen Blossoms by Alan S. Clifton. And thanks to Masako Fukui, ABC Radio Archives, and the National Film and Sound Archive. Occupational Hazards was produced by Michelle Rayner, and the sound engineer was Tim Simons.
Stay with us on ABC Radio National after the news. It's Airplay. Today, King Tide by Australian playwright Catherine Thompson. Sal, once a leading journalist, has retreated to a beach house on the New South Wales south coast to cope with the death of her son. Her peace is disturbed when her daughter Beck invites a Japanese backpacker to stay. That's King Tide on Airplay, right after the news on ABC Radio National.
What can you say in Singapore, where the job of the media is not to criticise, but to take part in the process of nation building?
All the TV stations, all our newspapers, radio stations are all run by one company, owned by the government.
But as one of the most wired nations in the world, the emerging new media is shaking things up.
The power of the internet has actually taken the PAP by surprise.
What Can I Say in Singapore? You can download this 360 documentary from the Radio National website.